Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. In that war, few people have commanded more respect, I think, certainly at a relatively tender age, than our first guest. He is the senior editor at a marvelous new institution, Conservative Review, previously the policy director for the Madison Project, but a man whose influence in Washington, I think, is very much growing and remarkable. He is Daniel Horowitz, and it is a pleasure to welcome him back to our microphones. Daniel, thank you very much for taking a few minutes to join us.
Great to be with you, Frank, but unfortunately that influence doesn't seem to be translating into sanity in the U.S. Senate.
I think it's bigger than all of us at the moment. The insanity of which you speak, of course, is most evident of late in the decision by the United States Senate to approve almost unanimously this so-called Corker-Cardin legislation concerning the deal with Iran. Just to calibrate, we've been talking about it a lot here. Remind us what that bill did and why it was such a disaster.
I have followed almost every major legislative battle over the past 10 years, the House, the Senate. I don't think I've ever seen something like this, where they passed a bill that is messaged and sold to the public as something 180 degrees the opposite, antithetical to what it actually is and what it actually does. You turn on your top-of-the-hour news breaks, you watch cable news, what you've been hearing the last 24 hours is that the Senate almost unanimously passed a bill to require Obama to obtain approval for his Iran deal when he submits that deal probably later next month to the Congress. Congress must have buy-in, and we have peace in our time because, well, by golly, Congress is going to rein him in. And what this bill does is the exact opposite. It actually consummates Obama's authority to unilaterally cut a deal with Iran, which is at least it's either a treaty or it's certainly something that requires Congress to affirmatively support. But instead, what it actually does is give Obama the authority to cut the deal, take off sanctions. The only way to stop this, pursuant to this bill, is by having two-thirds of both houses of Congress disapprove of Obama's action. Unless they can muster those votes, the deal goes through, the sanctions are lifted. So we could just say, from the passage of this bill, the deal goes through, because there is no political way to ever muster the requisite votes to overturn this. I would add that immediately after the Senate passed that, House Democrats, 150 of them signed a letter indicating that they will never override Obama's veto against Congress on this issue. In other words, that means Republicans will never have the votes to overturn the deal if this bill goes through, and they'll have no one to blame but themselves because they have agreed to this convoluted and backwards process.
Well, and more to the point, Daniel, they have actually legitimated this mutation, this morphing beyond recognition of the constitutional requirement, as you say, for the Senate to serve as a kind of check and balance on administration executive actions with respect to treaty making. I'll be talking shortly with a very thoughtful talk radio host about what the implications of that might be for the future. But why do you think members of the United States Senate, including some who voted against this bill on a cloture motion, like Ted Cruz, for example, Marco Rubio voted in favor of it when it came to final passage?
So there's a very important lesson to be learned here about charlatans and organizations and groups that help message and they help sell to the public legislation in a way that's completely opposite of what it does. As upset as I am at some of these members for not having the guts to vote against it, it's understandable why they did what they did, because every last person who turns on the news is going to come away with the impression that this was the only opportunity to get congressional buy-in, and Congress has to approve of the deal. So the perception out there is really the opposite of what it does. So members who are rightfully upset about this legislation, they were scared to vote against it because they figured that their rationale would be lost on the broader public. It would appear that if they're going soft on Iran, as if they're voting against congressional authority.
One of the groups who may be making this claim, and obviously had considerable influence on legislators in not just figuring out how to act on final passage, but in positioning themselves on this incredibly cynical, as you say, and manipulative piece of legislation, was a group called the American Israel Public Affairs Council, or AIPAC, usually called for shorthand Israel's lobby in the United States. Talk about this organization and the role that it's played. You wrote a very, very important and I think quite courageous critique of AIPAC's role. How did that factor into decisions on, you know, this bill and how to position themselves on it?
Sure. I mean, I think everyone in the, you know, every American voter understands that there's more to Washington than what you see on the surface. But seldom do you see an organization that works completely counter to their stated mission. Everyone assumes AIPAC is this pro-Israel group, and they're certainly very deeply troubled by Iran, and they want to protect our security, Israel's security. In fact, what they are is a group, and at least at the leadership level, they are a group of very activist Democrats who are committed to shielding Obama and the Democrats from any embarrassment concerning their appeasement of Iran and their treatment of Israel, certainly Obama's treatment of Israel. So that in itself is appalling, that they'd be more concerned about their own political connections. But this is where the rubber meets the road in the destructive nature of a group like AIPAC being a wolf in sheep's clothing. If you didn't have AIPAC, what you would be left with is a typical partisan split. You'd be left with Democrats appeasing Iran, implementing policies that endanger Israel and certainly endanger our security as well. But you would have Republicans and certainly the conservatives who would have no qualms, they would have no reservations about opposing it, just like they oppose Obamacare, they oppose amnesty and other left-wing policies of this administration. And the public, it would be laid bare before the public, wow, this is a terrible bill. This gives Obama the full latitude to continue on his dangerous appeasement of Iran. What AIPAC did here was a sleight of hand. They used their notoriety and their authority as the premier pro-Israel organization and said, hey guys, this is what's good for Israel. This is a great bill. We get a unanimous vote to have congressional buy-in to ensure that Congress could scrutinize the Iran deal. And they manipulated the process. They whipped and advocated against conservatives who were trying to make this better. They were in the Senate offices saying very false things about where members stood in an effort to get them to back down and not offer an amendment requiring Iran to recognize Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state as a prerequisite for taking off sanctions. It is the height of perfidy.
Among so many other examples of how they actually work directly at cross purposes with the express desires and really the urgent pleadings of the elected government of Israel. And I couldn't agree with you more that this is a very black day for not only an organization that has over the years played an important role, both here in the United States and for Israel, but that has, I'm afraid, really lost its moorings and become perhaps an engine of the destruction of the state of Israel if this thing plays out as I fear it might well. Daniel Horowitz of the Conservative Review, we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. There's so much more to talk about. In fact, we didn't even get to your 10 top most appalling acts of appeasement by President Obama of Iran. But that will be a subject for another day soon, I hope. And in the meantime, again, thank you for your courage in helping all of us understand what is being done in the name of not only Israel's security, but our own, that is going to imperil, I fear, both. Next up, Jan Michelson joins us from the great state of Iowa. We'll talk with him about what Americans are thinking there and elsewhere about our national security concerns and what is being done in Washington to preserve them. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the Center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states. One that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
It's been over 7 years since a church group from another state brought a couple hundred refugees to the rural county where I live. I wanted to know, how could they do this? What was the governmental process that allowed the resettlement of refugees to a county ill-prepared to assimilate them? Employment opportunities were scarce. The health department was not familiar with illnesses and mental health problems of people who came from parts of the third world. The school system was not prepared to teach large numbers of students who didn't speak English.
That's author Ann Corcoran discussing her new book, Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement and the Hijra to America. She explains how Muslim immigrants are being quietly resettled into American towns without vetting them, even for terrorist links. Corcoran also explains how the global jihad movement is using immigration as a stealth campaign to spread its influence in America. You can read Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement and the Hijra to America on securefreedom.org or purchase a copy on Amazon.com.
This is Frank Gaffney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined for the first time by Jan Michelson. He is a talk radio show host in the great state of Iowa. He hosts the Michelson in the Morning program at WHO News in Des Moines. He has, among many marvelous attributes that commend him to us, the role of one of the participants in a very important National Security Action Summit that the Center for Security Policy will be sponsoring in Des Moines next week. And I couldn't be more pleased to have him with us to talk a little bit about that program and more broadly, what's on the mind of people in Iowa when it comes to, well, the national security of the United States. Jan, welcome. It's very good to have you with us, sir, and I look forward very much to meeting you in person next week.
Thank you. It's my honor. I've followed your commentary for years, and I've always been inspired and informed by it, sir.
Well, thank you, and I look forward to doing much more of that together with you in both this event and with your program. Jan, one of the things that we're trying to do with this program, of course, in Des Moines, is to provide a vehicle, an issues forum kind of format for people both at the national level, including, it turns out, four or five of the actual or putative presidential candidates, but a lot of other people as well, both at the national level and in the state, on several topics. We're going to talk about the global jihad, including the Iran deal. We're going to talk about hollowing out of our military and what needs to be done there, the protection of our electric grid, and immigration, a very thorny issue. And we've been very pleased that you're willing to help us sort of think through these issues, and notably the immigration topic. Why do you think it's important that we have this kind of conversation at this particular moment in time in your state?
Because most of the time we talk about immigration, we're talking about the economic impact. Iowa, because it's an agribusiness-centered state, has been visited by thousands and thousands and thousands of illegal and legal immigration, and now the refugee programs, mainly devised to provide cheap labor for Iowa's agribusinesses. Most of the time, we don't think about it from a national security point of view, but the events in Texas, I think, it highlights this.
Jan Michelson is our guest. He is a talk radio show professional out of the great state of Iowa. He has a Michelson in the Morning program in Des Moines and will be participating in our National Security Action Summit next week. And talk a little bit more about the national security aspect, Jan, of this immigration, well, disaster, really, when you throw in the illegals and the legals and the refugees and so on, as we're witnessing in states all over this country.
Well, the legal part of this is now being done through the refugee program. Now, the illegal stuff is now sort of been made legal by the Obama non-enforcement and his discretionary enforcement stuff. So people are now just absorbing the economic costs of that. But the national security part of this, people don't think about most of the time, at least here in Iowa, because we don't see what's going on beneath the surface. Just right up the street from us here and right out across the border is Minnesota, Minneapolis. They have been taking advantage of the refugee program by the thousands and thousands. They've imported thousands of Somali Muslims to that area. 1,000, I just read this the other day, 1,000 Somalis now work at the Minneapolis International Airport.
This is really a stunning development, and it's not unique to Minnesota. It is
true across the country. It's a wrinkle on the same thing, though. I think the word we use in Iowa, dumb.
Yeah, I think that's the technical term for it, of course, across the country. But again, why this is so important, and I'm so appreciative for you sort of bringing your perspective to bear on this, is that it's common sense, and yet we as a nation have really departed from its application with regard to
I don't think the nation has, Frank. I really don't think it's a national departure. It's the political class. It's the leadership class that has varying motivations for doing it, economic and social. You've got the State Department in complicity with the UN running a Muslim jihad by importing refugees from even more, apparently, Syrians on the way.
Yeah.
And this is just thought of as, well, this is just status quo. It's another day that ends in Y, and I complained about this a few days ago on the air, and I got a listener writing, well, you can't refuse immigrants to the United States on the basis of their Islamist religion, because the Constitution has this no religious test clause. And this guy was totally serious about that.
You're a serious student of the Constitution, and I think it's important to explicate how wrongheaded that is.
Well, yeah, it was designed to make sure that you couldn't use any religious arguments to exclude anybody from the pursuit of a national office. And that was designed to get the country away from state-sponsored religion. That's what we were getting out from under the thumb of that when their country was just getting started. But now that's being, that language is being used against us. And it, all the time, the cliches on the other side are dominating the arguments, and that's what I'm going to be talking about on Saturday.
Well, let me sort of pivot on that point, because again, Jen Michelson, you are somebody who lives by freedom of speech. It's under assault by some of the same people that you're talking about. It's really problematic to be bringing into this country. And their enablers. And again, a similar kind of mutation is taking place in our Constitution by saying, well, freedom of religion assures that nobody can have anything said that offends them about their religion. The First Amendment to the Constitution's other provision, freedom of speech, notwithstanding. Talk a little bit about what's up with that.
Well, you saw what happened in Texas with that. Since we have religious freedom and all of our religious notions are protected, we have equality before the law. When that tension exists, that tension is protected by that zone where your personal offenses do not trump somebody else's rights. And as somebody once said, I'll fight to the death for your rights of First Amendment expressions. But when it comes to being offended, you're on your own.
Mm-hmm. Jen, let me turn to one other issue, which is very much on my mind. We were talking about it a short while ago in the previous segment. The Corker-Cardin bill that was just approved by almost the entire United States Senate yesterday. Again, as a serious student of the Constitution and one of its important provisions, namely the treaty-making authority of the United States Senate, what did you make of the fact that we're seemingly getting out of that business, or the Senate is, that is?
If they relinquish their authority, in essence, they don't have any. And if they don't have any, that gives the executive a carte blanche to make agreements. And the problem is with those agreements, if we're going to call them treaties, the bent way that people view treaties now grants them almost carte blanche, because the current political class says that treaties, because of the supremacy clause, is equal to other provisions of the Constitution, even can trump congressional authority, or even can amend the Constitution. And that is a doctrine that was tried in the mid-50s in the first generation of the use of treaties with the UN Treaty. Then John Foster Dulles, who was the Secretary of State, I think it was under Eisenhower, got up before the Bar Association and said, these treaties, we can even amend the Bill of Rights with the treaty. That so offended that generation of the senators, a guy named Bricker from Ohio, got up and said, no, it doesn't. And he started the process to amend the Constitution to say that no treaty can have any power to amend the Constitution or bridge any other pre-existing constitutional authority.
Jen, we are out of time as well. You know the vicissitudes of this business better than I. We have to let you go. Thank you very much for joining us, though. We look forward very much to our visit with you in person on Saturday of next week in Des Moines, Iowa. In the meantime, keep up the terrific work you do at Michelson in the Morning at WHO. Next up, former U.S. Ambassador to the Vatican, Francis Rooney, joins us to talk about the long war and the role of religion in it, both that of the Islamists and that of other faiths. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're all part of your community.
We all play a role in keeping our community safe.
So protect your everyday.
If you see something suspicious, say something to local authorities.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. God bless Megyn Kelly. The Fox News anchor broke earlier this week with several network colleagues and most other journalists' party line concerning events in Garland, Texas. She did so by standing forthrightly for freedom of speech and the right guaranteed in our Constitution to exercise it, especially when it might offend others. She refuses to join in professing a commitment to the First Amendment while insisting on self-censorship. More to the point, Ms. Kelly gets that we have to offend jihadists by refusing to accommodate their determined efforts to force us all to submit to the supremacist Islamic code called Sharia. If we fail to do so, we will embolden them to believe that they are succeeding in that holy war, which assures there will be more violence, not less. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts, now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word, answer. That's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. No matter what happens, if it matters to you and you listen long enough, you'll learn what it means and different ways to think about it. That's why we're here. Do this better than any station in town. Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, I'm very pleased to say, joined by Ambassador Francis Rooney. We have been privileged to have him on from time to time since he left his appointed position as the U.S. Ambassador to the Holy See, often in connection with his writings about the role of the Holy See these days, the Catholic Church, notably his marvelous book, The Global Vatican. An inside look at the Catholic Church, world politics, and the extraordinary relationship between the United States and the Holy See. We were also moved to try to reconnect with him in connection with a very important piece that he wrote recently at The Hill newspaper concerning the questions that are vexing all of us, I think, of ISIS and the phenomenon of Islamic extremism and the long war. Mr. Ambassador, welcome back. It's good to have you with us, sir.
Thank you for having me back on.
I want to talk with you about a couple of things, but maybe we could start with a proposition that you reminded us of in this piece in the Hill newspaper, namely the way George W. Bush characterized back in 2001 what we were confronting. And he put it, quote, "We are a country awakened to danger and called to defend freedom against," as you put it, "an onslaught by terrorists practicing," quote, "a fringe form of Islamic extremism," unquote. Now, you're a serious student of these matters. Is, in your judgment, that a correct characterization of the sort of nature of jihad and the role that it plays in authoritative Islam, not simply more extreme versions of it?
Well, I think it was perhaps more of a fringe movement in 2001, as we were first landed in the situation and it may appear to be now with the proliferation of al-Qaeda cells and ISIS hegemonic activity in many places of the world. But at the end of the day, we've got to hope that there is a bulwark of secular Muslims that will not be radicalized and want to practice their religion like everybody else wants to and not apply Sharia law and get with the program of living in the 21st century. If not, we're going to have a real long struggle taking them all out.
Well, a long war indeed. I think you're right that we should hope for that, and we certainly should be adopting and following policies that are conducive to it. And I guess this is one of the things that I wonder if you've been as concerned about as I, that the policies that we're pursuing, notably embracing, as the Obama administration has done, the Muslim Brotherhood and other groups like it, that we may, to say nothing of Iran, for crying out loud, we may actually be working very much at cross purposes with that hope and sort of cultivating the notion that actually the Islamists within the Muslim community are the strong horse, as bin Laden used to say.
Well, that's part of why I wrote the article. I'm just kind of sick to see 6 years of not referring to this terror as religiously inspired Islamic Muslim or anything. That ridiculous phrase, an overseas contingency operation, instead of considering this thing the kind of war on the Western world that it is a little bit disheartening to me. So I wrote the article to try to say maybe people should think about what are we facing here and the level of the threat that these people pose to the modern world.
Well, I'm so heartened by your clarity on this point. And one of the reasons why it's particularly relevant, of course, is that just last weekend we saw people who were warning of some of these features, specifically the threat to Western civilization posed by these jihadists, very narrowly averting, a massacre. And I just wonder what your thoughts are as a former ambassador to one of the centers of religious life in the world, the Holy See, Ambassador Francis Rooney. You have thoughts as to whether we have really, in the name of political correctness or in the name of freedom of religion or so on, actually allowed serious infringements on another First Amendment freedom, namely freedom of speech.
Yeah, I'd like to make 3 points in that respect. First of all, it's just the unfortunate nature of humanity that progressive or liberal people don't seem to want to respect is that appeasement's never worked. Hiding problems under the rugs never worked. We've got to confront them and have an open and honest debate. And that has to happen concerning Sharia law and Islamic terrorism and all that. And so when we do appease, and it gets a little more insidious when you look at some of these organizations that you've referred to in the past who are helping the Americans figure out how to appease, like CARE and MAF and things like that, I think we just aid and abet the people that want to destroy freedom and destroy the Western way of life. So that's one point, is appeasement doesn't work. The other point is that I think that religions have a role to play, and that we've seen some people speak up recently about that, Admiral Freeman being one, Ambassador and Admiral Freeman, that the religious leaders have a role to play in combating this the same way that, like Truman, tried to get religions to combat communism. And so far, really, Pope Benedict and Pope Francis have been the only religious leaders to speak up. And it would be real helpful if all religious leaders would speak up and say, the First Amendment protects us all, and it's under attack right now by this radical extremist interpretation of Islam, and that, as Pope Benedict said in Regensburg, and Pope Francis just said recently at his trips, the Islamicists need to figure out how to interpret their religion in a way that's consistent with the rest of the world.
Well, unfortunately, they seem to be bent on changing the rest of the world as to conform to their interpretation of their faith, and this is really the rub, isn't it? I'm wondering, again, from your experience representing the United States in the Vatican, Ambassador Rooney, but also, of course, as a prominent Catholic in the United States as well, whether you are concerned, as I am, that what we've seen happening as part of this sort of, well, the Brotherhood calls it civilization jihad, the effort to kind of suborn the church by practice they bill as bridge building or interfaith dialogue, is that something that is working against the kind of appeal that you're making for people of faith to stand up against this jihadism, if they are in some ways at least being induced by their interlocutors in these kinds of conversations to silence criticism?
I think the interfaith dialogue and reaching out, building cultural bridges like Pope Benedict spoke of, are all fine as long as they're accompanied by the strength of principle as well. But when you don't have the strength of principle, then that becomes the overriding goal, then it becomes interpreted as appeasement and giving in, and that's the problem. You know, I put a quote in the book, I think it's from Ben Franklin, I might be mistaken on that, where he said, people that will choose security over freedom deserve neither. And that's kind of where we are with this stuff.
One of the points that you make in your piece, and again, we're speaking with Ambassador Francis Rooney, who formerly represented us in the Vatican. He's the author of a relatively recent article entitled ISIS, Islamic Extremism, and the Long War in the Hill newspaper. You reminded us of the role that the church specifically played both in the effort that Harry Truman famously made to try to check the ascendancy of communism, the last terrible totalitarian ideology that tried to destroy us, now being, you know, imitated by these Sharia guys, but also the important role of Pope John Paul II in the efforts that he and Margaret Thatcher and most especially Ronald Reagan made to try to check and ultimately defeat Soviet communism. Where are we at the moment, as you see it, with respect to a similar kind of effort?
Well, I think it's quite possible, as George Weigel said, that this Regensburg speech someday down the road, when this thing is all solved somehow, and I've got to feel confident that the Western world will somehow solve it. We're not going to go let them impose 10th century behavior on 8 billion people. But that Regensburg will be seen as a major turning point, kind of like I don't think that Churchill realized what the Iron Curtain speech would do when he gave it. And as an important milestone about speaking up frankly and clearly about the abuse of the use of religion to justify violence, about the inappropriate nature of spreading the word by the sword in the 21st century. And then maybe that will lead people to call on some heightened levels of interdiction and containment against these wrongdoers than we've done so far. That's what I was kind of calling for the article, too. If you look at these people as the equivalent of Nazi Germany or World War II Japan, you wouldn't be letting them flying in and out of our country.
It's a very basic common sense proposition. Ambassador Rooney, we have to leave it with that proposition, but I hope you'll come back to us again soon to further discuss all of these points, because they really are central to the kind of future that we're going to bequeath to our children and our grandchildren. God bless you, sir, and thank you for your service to our country. Next up, we'll be speaking with Bill Gertz. He'll take us inside the ring straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I'm Jared Ogden, former Navy SEAL and member of Team Military on National Geographic Channel's Ultimate Survival Alaska. I want to tell you about an issue that you probably haven't heard much about. Thousands of America's veterans are suffering from occupational and environmental exposures that they were exposed to while serving in the military. We call these the toxic wounds of war. From Agent Orange and Gulf War illness to post-9/11 burn pit exposure and heavy metals in the air, and other toxic exposures that we don't fully understand. The Sergeant Sullivan Center is a powerful voice in our nation's capital, standing watch over these forgotten wounded. These men and women can't do it alone, and they need your help today. Every dollar raised by Sergeant Sullivan Center goes to medical research, public awareness, and advocacy. You can make a tax-deductible donation today at www.sergeantsullivancenter.org. That's SGT. SullivanCenter.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
I'm Fred Fleitch with the Center for Security Policy. One of President Obama's worst foreign policy failings is the lack of a strategy to defeat Al-Qaeda and ISIS. These terrorist groups are part of a global movement to establish Islamic supremacy and Sharia through violence. This movement is called the Global Jihad Movement. It will not be defeated without a strategy that recognizes its true nature. In January 2015, we issued a comprehensive strategy to defeat the Global Jihad Movement. It is called the Secure Freedom Strategy and is based on National Security Directive 75, the strategy that President Ronald Reagan used to defeat the global totalitarian threat of his time, the Soviet Union. Like President Reagan's strategy, we lay out a comprehensive plan on how the United States government can be reorganized and focused to understand and defeat the global jihad movement. You can read the Secure Freedom Strategy at securefreedom.org, or you can purchase a copy on Amazon.com. I'm Fred Fleitz.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're going for a tour inside the ring. That, of course, is the title of the very highly regarded prize-winning column written by our guest, Bill Gertz, the preeminent national security journalist of our day. At the Washington Times. He is also the senior editor for the Washington Free Beacon and a regular here at Secure Freedom Radio. Bill, good to have you with us as always.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the show.
Well, there's a lot of things to talk about going on inside the ring at the moment. Maybe we might start with something we speculated about last week. It's now happened. The president has nominated, as you thought he might, the commandant of the Marine Corps, General Joe Dunford, to become the next chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Talk a bit about that choice, if you would, and what it might mean for policy, as you see it, assuming he is going to be confirmed.
Well, you know, the Marines traditionally are among the more conservative of the four military services. So it's hoped that he'll try and correct the ship of state a little bit from a military perspective. However, as I reported in my column a couple weeks ago, he has made certain politically correct noises about integrating women into combat positions. We haven't heard him on climate change as his losing contender, Admiral Locklear of Pacific Command, who was eyeing for that job. This week's column, I reported that as a result of the Dunford selection and the pick of General Selva as the deputy, who is very good on China, this is a big setback for the pro-China advocates within the Obama administration. They were banking on Locklear getting the position and then advancing their pro-China agenda at the expense of U.S. allies in Asia. Critics of Locklear have said that he's tried to slow roll the administration's signature pivot to Asia, or rebalancing to Asia. So we'll have to see. Hopefully this will be a better choice than Locklear.
Well, I think it will be a better choice on a whole lot of counts. But as you say, it remains to be seen how this might affect the robustness with which we address the Chinese threat, which nobody has done a better job of chronicling than you, Bill. Also, we'll be watching closely whether, as commandant, now outgoing, he, General Dunford, does the right thing with respect to women in combat on the basis of what we have seen coming out of the test results of the various experiments that the Marines have been running, which suggests that women should not, in fact, be put into ground combat positions. Bill, let me turn to a topic that you've also been describing as a little bit of a bizarre twist. The Secretary of Defense is threatening a presidential veto if Congress gives more money for defense, even though, last time I checked, Ash Carter was making the case that more money is needed. What is going on here?
This is really the test of where the rubber meets the road on Obama administration opposition to really robust defense spending. Clearly, the members of the Republicans in the House particularly came up with a novel approach to fixing the defense sequestration cuts, which are devastating the military right now. And they said, well, let's take the Overseas Contingency Operations account, what they call the OCO account, and plus that up and allow the military to use that money to overcome the sequestration limits. Well, the defense secretary this week came out strongly against it. And the reason, I'm told by defense officials, is that the president doesn't want the military alone to benefit from something like that. He wants to have all of the sequestration cuts lifted so that he can use them for his domestic programs and other agencies, which are still under sequestration.
Bill, this is coming against the backdrop of so many problems around the world, contingencies, if you will, around the world that are demanding a greater American presence and capability and investment in more modern capabilities at that. Let's touch on several of them quickly. The North Koreans are, according to some of your splendid reporting, now progressing rather quickly towards having submarine-launched ballistic missiles. What does that portend, among all of the other problems that we're witnessing in Asia, for the security of the United States? And again, does this bear on the question of whether the president ought to veto a greater investment in defense capabilities at this moment?
Well, it's interesting. Yes, the North Koreans conducted the third test. This was an ejection test of a new submarine-launched ballistic missile. This is a new nuclear delivery capability for Pyongyang. And this happened on Obama's watch. The administration has done zero in order to deter, dissuade, prevent North Korea from building up its nuclear arsenal. First that happened on the president's watch was China's transfer of strategic launcher technology. We've now seen that show up in North Korea's KN-08 road mobile ICBM, very difficult to find. And now we've got a second difficult-to-find strategic nuclear delivery vehicle in this SLBM. It really highlights the utter failure of the Obama administration's non-proliferation policies and its policies in Asia.
Another example of that is, of course, the buildup that the Russians are engaged in of their nuclear forces, even at a time of very difficult economic conditions in Moscow. Bill, at this juncture, even as the Russians, and you again are chronicling this practically daily, acting with those nuclear forces in an ever more belligerent fashion, including penetrating or threatening to penetrate our air defense zones and threatening nuclear attacks on our allies and friends, we're talking about sending American money to the Russian nuclear program. What is that about?
I would call it arms control run amok. This is one of those government programs that was started after the Soviet Union collapsed to try to secure Russian materials, and it took on a life of its own to the point where in January, Russia canceled this program, said, we don't want your money anymore. And yet we have these liberal arms control advocates within the Obama administration. They're preparing to spend more than $60 million this year to secure Russian nuclear facilities and materials. And it's absolutely insanity. Eric Edelman, the former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, said, because money is fungible, the U.S. taxpayer is ultimately funding the Russian strategic nuclear buildup, which includes new missiles, new submarines, a new bomber. It's just, like I say, the height of policy insanity.
It is. It's obscene, is really what it amounts to. And again, I think the American people, were they aware of what we're doing, both with respect to dismantling our own nuclear capabilities and ignoring, let alone helping enable, even in a small way, the buildup of threats to this country, they would be appalled and indeed outraged. Bill, let me turn to one other topic that you've reported on. Against the backdrop that we're hearing more and more that Al-Shabaab, the Al-Qaeda-linked terrorist organization in Somalia, has operatives and cells, perhaps, in this country, notably in Minnesota, and has been threatening to blow up the Mall of America in that state. You've described how more Al-Qaeda elements seem to be migrating to Somalia from Yemen. Give us an update on that story.
Yeah, like rats fleeing a sinking ship, the conflict in Yemen right now with the Saudis trying to oust pro-Iranian rebels there, there's been an influx of, by some estimates, as many as 600 Al-Qaeda fighters are fleeing Yemen and heading to Somalia, one of the ungoverned spaces in the northern part of Somalia. Now, Somalia has made some progress in trying to gain control of the country, and there's been a lot of international support. This week, Secretary of State John Kerry made a stop in Mogadishu, where Somali officials, according to U.S. officials who told me, informed him of this problem, and Kerry promised to provide support but gave no specifics and left the Somalis wondering if the U.S. is going to do anything about this new emerging Al-Qaeda threat on the Horn of Africa.
It's profoundly worrying, needless to say, among the many things that are going on inside the ring and inside official Washington and around the world that are vexing. Bill Gertz, nobody covers them better than you at the Washington Free Beacon and the Washington Times. Keep up the great work and come back to us again next week. I hope the rest of you will do the same. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.